Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. Well, here we are in the new studios. I am in the new studio. There are two of them, actually. One is still under construction, and I'm broadcasting from one that is... Actually, the whole offices and studios at PRN are and Gary Knowles' offices and studios are under construction. So it's a... strange experience. Everything here is brand new. It's in a brand new part of town. It's everything is just sort of being constructed while I sit here. And for somebody who is completely and utterly, notoriously, famously finicky about everything and has, a certified case of OCD, this is an interesting experience to be working in a place where everything is just... being constructed and being put up and adjusted as this is happening. my father used to say, my father, the chemical engineer, he used to have this piece of all these different rules that engineers have or that working engineers have. And he used to say the most important rule was when you were building something or when you were designing something is, and this this allowed for adjustment to anything and to expect anything. He said, the rule was, if something can go wrong, it will. I think that's a good rule for life. This past Tuesday, I turned, not literally because I probably get dizzy, but I turned 70 years old. It's just it's just extraordinary to me, absolutely extraordinary, and there are reasons for that. I mean, I actually clocked in my 3 score and 10, and it turns out that's from the, by the way, that's from the 90th Psalm, and it says, the days of our years are 3 score years and 10, and if by reason of strength they be 4 score years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. Very cheery stuff. A lot of the Bible is very cheery. This is the way, I mean, imagine, you know, 3 score years. But if you live to be 80, don't make a big deal out of it. Don't think it's hot stuff, because it's all labor and sorrow. And for it, it's soon cut off and we fly away. Who knows, right? Anyway, I turned 70. And actually, on June 16th, 1945, at 6:49 p.m., how do I know that? Because there was a birth certificate. There was an actual birth certificate, 6:49 p.m. But in fact, 6:49 p.m., when I was born, was 5:49, wartime. I don't know, you know, I'm very bad at figuring these things out, but I guess that gave people more time to work, more daylight hours to work or whatever. Anyhow, so I was born at 5:49 wartime, which is interesting, symbolically and actually, because I feel like I've been a war my whole life. But I share this with anybody else who was born during the war, so it's not particular to me. And so I'm a child of World War II. I was born between the German surrender and the war with the Japanese still going on, and the nuclear bombs were yet to come, and various invasions of islands were yet to come. It was still a time of terrible warfare in the Pacific. Although when I was born, the war in Germany, the war in Europe, rather, was over. The Germans had surrendered unconditionally. So am I a baby boomer? I don't know if I'm a baby boomer or not. I think the baby boomers sort of cover anybody who the returning troops, when all the millions of men who had been away for the duration, right? When the millions of men who had been away came back from the war, you know, sometimes it took as much as a year to get back from the war, from various theaters of the war. But, well, maybe 9 or 10 months. But they didn't come back, right? But they started coming back almost immediately, and they came back in waves and waves and waves. And, of course, there was lots of sex and lots of babies. And there was a gigantic crop of babies born in the in 1940, you know, like in 1940s, in the mid to late 40s and in the 50s. And these are called baby boomers, all of whom now are presenting a big problem, I guess, for Social Security and all kinds of other problems, retiring and other problems. But I'm not sure exactly if I'm a baby boomer, because my father, for one thing, didn't come home from the war. He didn't come home from the war because he never went to the war, which was a subject of tremendous and enduring lifelong regret for my poor father, because he was a very aggressive, big, strong, very aggressive guy who had very strong opinions, hated the Germans, hated the Nazis, Jewish, you know, and had been a champion Olympic swimmer, and is almost an Olympic swimmer. He had was on the swim team at Jamaica High School in New York City before he went to City College, and he participated in the 1936 Olympic trials. How old was he then? Let's see. He was born in 1917, so 19. I guess in his freshman year in college, he went to Jamaica High School, back to Jamaica High School, and they had the tryouts for the Olympics, and he lost by a fraction of a second to a guy who ultimately took the silver medal in some swimming event at the Olympics. He was that good a swimmer. So he was something of an athlete. But when he went down to volunteer, which he did almost immediately after December 7th, 1941, he was rejected because he had a bad disc in his back, which he knew about and, you know, pretended wasn't true. He had back troubles, and I think it happened from the swimming. But so he was rejected from service in the armed forces, and he had to be one of those guys who walked around, who looked, you know, who was big, strong, who was carrying and lifting things, who was looked perfectly healthy. And he got a lot of bad vibes and a lot of bad looks from people. People in those days, often, you know, whose husbands and sons and you know, people whose brothers were all over in the war, people who were being killed or wounded or in danger of their lives for years on end, suffering tremendous privation, and the fact that they themselves were home, you know, missing their loved ones in all sorts of different ways. When apparently healthy-looking men were walking around, rejected for one reason or another for service, or they weren't serving for some other reason, who knows what it was, maybe George Bush Jr. type reasons, you know, where he just got out of it in Vietnam. But my father desperately wanted to volunteer for all sorts of reasons. He was patriotic. You know, he loved his country, hated the Nazis, and he wanted to volunteer. But they wouldn't let him. And he was angry about that and regretted that his whole life. It affected, in fact, it affected his whole life. It turned him, because I get some testimony from his sisters, his older sister. I mean, they're all long gone now. But I had some testimony from from my aunts that before that, he wasn't, you know, he was kind of good-natured. I mean, sometimes it's hard for me to believe because he was, when I knew him when I was growing up, he had a terrible temper, a violent temper, and he was angry about everything all the time, or seemed to be. Although he could laugh a lot. He had a great jolly laugh when he felt like laughing. But they said his whole nature changed during the war. And it wasn't the usual where combat overseas changed him. It was the fact that he couldn't serve. And a lot of people insulted, you know, got into fights with people. People insulted him, said, "What's your problem? You know, are you evading a draft?" You know, people would insult him. So anyhow. So I was born at 5:49 wartime, 6:49 p.m., in the evening, June 16th, 1945. And it's interesting, to me, it's interesting, and maybe for people in my generation who used to, were very much into this kind of stuff, horoscopes and, you know, fate and psychics and stuff like that. It's interesting that I know when I took my first breath. Well, I don't know. You know, they filled the they filled the birth certificate out for 6:49 p.m., but I don't know what exactly. But let's say 6:49 p.m., I took my first breath, you know, my first breath as a human in this incarnation on this planet. That's got to mean something. I mean, it's really got to mean something that the minute that you take your first breath, just like the minute you let out your last breath. Inspiration, the first breath you take in, inspiration, and then expiration, the last breath you let out. I've been present. I was present one time at the last breath of somebody on this earth, and there is something transcendent. There is something otherworldly about it. You know, I mean, I suppose if you don't believe in anything like that, it doesn't make any difference. But there is something very otherworldly about it. I mean, you can, when that last breath goes out, it's as if the soul is in the breath. You know, in the beginning, God created the earth. And, you know, it said, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was the breath of God. The breath of God was breathed on the earth, right? And there's something about that that first breath that you take in that becomes you in a way. I mean, that forms you in a way which is indescribable, unknowable, incomprehensible, but it becomes very much you. I suppose the place... but definitely the time that you take your first breath and the time that, you know, you let out your last breath, that the soul, it's like the soul comes into the body. Although, you know, people say the soul comes into the body at conception. So that's a whole other argument. But I believe it defines you. I remember I was there when my kids were born. And before that, they were... they were who they were, you know, they were swimming around in some amniotic fluid there. When they come into the world and have to take that first breath, you know, and some kids come into the world and they come in differently. Kids come in differently. If you've had kids, then you know, they come in differently. And people have natures. They have, I mean, like I say, in the 60s, it was a big thing. This is my generation, right? I'm 70 now. People call it the 60s generation, the baby boomers. But also I'm part of the 50s generation, and even actually growing up during the 40s. But people believed, there was a lot of, not necessarily belief, but a lot of horoscopes were cast, and people were, you know, were defined by, you know, by their place in the sun, you know, when they were born, when the planet, where the planets were, what their sign was, that kind of thing. And it all seems so stupid often. And I agree. I agree. It can seem very stupid, but it was, to me, and I saw my, so I saw my kids born, and the very minute they were born, and the very second they were born, when they came out of their mother, and then when there was this moment of hesitation, it's almost like a strange divine, I'm, you know, grasping for words here, but there's something, there is something supernatural about it. There's a time when a kid comes out of their mother's womb, and I was there for my two kids' birth, that they are something between a fish and a human being, or something swimming around in the ocean, which is unidentifiable. As soon as they come out of, and I don't want to get into the whole, like, you know, the issue of when does life begin or whatever, you know, life begins, I guess, probably at conception. But they become an actual human being, which is to say they are introduced to the joys and to the sorrows of this world, right, the minute they come out. But there's a moment when they come out, and they're still connected to the umbilical cord, when they're not breathing. Just a moment when they're not breathing. And I think, I don't know about this slapping that you see all the time. Maybe that's to get them to, but sometimes babies are held upside down to clear mucus from their bronchial, from their, you know, from their various passages so that they can take a breath. So this is strange moment. Is this life or death, or is this something in between? What is this? Between, you know, taking between coming out of their mother's womb and appearing in the world, you know, the first appearance on any stage here in the in this realm, and then something about then they wait and then they take a breath. Who are they? Where are they? What are they in that moment between coming out, being attached to that umbilical cord and coming out of that fluid and taking their first breath and using their lungs for the very first time? Very, very strange, interesting moment, I think. There's a moment in meditation when you're meditating and you sit and you breathe in, then you breathe out. And at the moment that you breathe out, there's a strange little moment after you breathe out which carries so much spiritual weight to it. When you breathe out, and before you take in your next breath, right there, it's that same kind of eternal pause. And in that pause is everything. In that pause is everything. There are pauses like that in life that seem to come from someplace. But when you can do that in meditation, when you breathe in, you're in, you know, that you're, it's inspiration. When you breathe out, it's expiration. And this is the way of life, inspiration, expiration, right? And we have trouble here. Like I said, everything on the studio is under construction, and I don't know if you can hear it directionally, but there is a lot of noise coming in because it's still working on the soundproofing for the studio. Now, you may not be able to hear it, and I hope you can't, but I can hear it, and it's sort of disconcerting. But I know there, like I say, this is a work in progress here. This is all a work in progress. And it looks as if, to me, it's if it's going to be quite a wonderful place. I mean, they've got everything really. They're starting from the beginning. They're not just, you know, they didn't inhabit somebody else's old studio. And there's a, you know, so there's an actual sort of lively discussion going on outside right now. And there's nothing much I can do, but it's distracting to me. But on the other hand, I'm confident that you really can't hear it. If you can, you could always let me know. Not much I can do about it, though. But they are, you know, continuing with the soundproofing, and that will get better as it goes along. So I was born at the end of sort of at the end of the war. I was born, and that's one of those strange pauses that I'm talking about. There was after, you know, all those years and all that slaughter and the tens of millions of people murdered and killed in battle and murdered in other ways in Europe, finally there was peace. There was finally peace. There was no combat anymore. The war was over there. And there was this great, you know, and everybody had to deal with the terrible agony and loss, and their lives were changed forever. The people who fought in the war, people who were rounded up and put in the concentration camps, everybody in the entire, you know, everybody in Europe and Russia, everywhere, you know, everybody in the whole world practically. But still it was going on in the Pacific. So I was born in that strange mid-air place between the wars. But in a way, I am a child, 70 years old that I am. I am a child of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And every generation has its troubles, you know, and its problems that it has to deal with the world. Sorry, the noise outside is pretty distracting. So I guess I'll have to get used to it until they improve it. So at the in the 40s, like, and you know, every generation has its troubles, it has its trials and tribulations, and every generation has something that when you look back on history, and if you're old enough to remember these things, now you'd have to be pretty old to remember some of these older generations, but they all have something which defined it in a way. Well, depending on your class and race always, right? I was born at the sort of lower edge of the middle class, white at the lower edge of the middle class, but the 20s, for instance, had their you know, their jazz and their booze, right, and their craziness, which partially resulted in the tremendous stock market crash. Everybody was completely out of control. There was a lot of mania there in the 20s. so jazz and booze. And the 30s was, of course, the Depression. And this is my parents' generation, the Depression. And then the war, the first half of the 40s, you know, in this country, it started earlier in Europe. But the first half of the 40s was, you know, starting in 1941, going to 45, was the war and people's involvement in the war. The entire country was involved, just not the not just the men who fought overseas and, you know, the combat troops. It was, but the 30s was a depression, time of tremendous privation and suffering and sorrow for people. my father, that was my father's generation. If you're a baby boomer, that's our parents' generation, the 30s and the 40s. And later on, the 40s, when people came home from the war, in the second part of the 40s, when people came home from the war, and having gone through all that and lived through the Depression and been in combat or in the service for all those years and suffering and want, I mean, it went from all the way from the beginning of the Depression from like around 1929, 1930, for basically for 15 years or more, when, you know, people had no work, they had no jobs, they had no food, they had no place to live, a lot of them. And then later on during the war, there was a lot of jobs and there was a lot of money floating around and people were doing better as far as food and shelter and everything. Because, you know, the war was good for business. The war was, you know, picked up business in every possible way, and the country mobilized. And but still, people had to do without a lot of things. And the main thing they did without was a lot of the women did without their men. A lot of children did without their fathers and their uncles and their brothers. People did without their relationships, without their love relationships. But later on in the 40s, when people started coming back, it was normality with a vengeance. And into the 50s, which now, well, I was born in 1945, so in 1950, I was 5 years old, and I was already starting, you know, like growing up in the 50s, basically. And it was a time of, it's, you know, every generation sort of was like reactive to the previous generation. I have some more water. It's a little dusty here in the studio when they are still constructing things. Uh, Could that all be from one? No, Poland Spring is from all different kinds of places. I'm sure it is from 25 different places. Who knows? Maybe it's from China. I don't know. So it was, you know, if you grew up in the 50s, if you were a child of the 50s, which I was till I was 15, and then it was 1960, everything was, it was a big stress on what was normal, on peace and quiet. People had been through 15 years of poverty, of suffering, of political, you know, turmoil, you know, the country, the tremendous, you know, uprooting and moving around. People lived in, you know, what they call Hoovervilles and towns. People were homeless. You know, millions of people were shifting around and homeless. People were homeless. They had hardly enough to eat. So that's suffering. And then, you know, the war and combat and never knowing whether you're going to be alive one minute or dead the next minute. I mean, you had no idea. And then you come back and everybody came back and everybody came back to their families or came back and got married. And everybody then, and you remember this if you lived then, and everything had to be just the way, everything was all about building houses, building suburbs, buying a car, getting, you know, the American dream, what's called the American dream, which is a very complicated thing. In some ways, the American dream turned into an American nightmare. And maybe it had its roots in nightmare class type stuff in the beginning. But, you know, everybody was striving to get the house and the car, and they wanted to get married, and they wanted to have the kids. And everything was going back to normal. Everything was going back to that. And it came back to normal with such a vengeance that everything became, and it was fine with the people who had been suffering for 15 years, or with most, I should say most of the people, not with everybody. There's always Allen Ginsberg and other people. But it was fine with people, not as if that, you know, the 50s, when you read about things like what was going on with the CIA and America overseas, and there was always corruption and political corruption. But daily life, as you saw it, you know, as a citizen of the country, was basically, it was peace and quiet, and everybody observed the rules, and everybody mowed their lawns and fixed the roofs of their houses, and everybody sat down to dinner at night, you know, after Dad got home from work. So that's how it was. Everything and all the fashions were extremely square, and sexuality seemed to have sort of disappeared. you think it would have been like a riotous time when people come home. Well, obviously, it was a lot of sex because there was a lot of babies. But on the outside, you know, look, you saw stuff on TV. TV started getting big in the 50s. You saw stuff on TV or ads in Life magazine and places like that, or ads on billboards. All this sex and violence was, there was plenty of sex and violence, you know, and especially the violence part for all the time before then. So when people got home, and in the 50s especially, sex and violence was played down a lot. There was a lot of, I mean, that was a time of everybody, there was a lot of repression. There was a lot of people who wanted everything to be very then conservative and very quiet and very peaceful, and they didn't want any disturbance, and they didn't want any expansiveness. There was plenty of expansiveness and spontaneity to last them the rest of their life and the next 10 lives that they were born into from the 30s and 40s. So the 50s was a very peaceful quiet. There were rules for everything. Everybody observed the rules. It was the Boy Scouts. It was the women stayed home and cooked, you know, and cleaned, and the men went to work, and everything was the way it was supposed to be. It was the American life, right? But then their children grew up, and they took a look at a lot of this stuff, and they looked behind and underneath, and they looked at it and decided and rebelled against it. There was this kind of rebellion, this feeling that they had enough of all this square stuff. Where was the sex? Where was the taking chances? You know, where was the? It's so ironic. I mean, their parents probably, you know, didn't really talk to them much about it. But talk about taking chances and living on the edge and being extreme. All these, my father's generation, all of our parents grew up suffering, never knew where the money was going to come from or the food or a place to live, every day suffering. And then going off to the war, never knowing if they were going to get a bullet in the head or they're going to get, you know, like blown up or something on some battlefield totally out of the blue, or some bomb would come, you know, some artillery shell would come down when they were sitting there eating their, you know, eating their K rations, and bang, that was the end of them. They were atomized. And the people at home didn't know if they were going to get a telegram or somebody knocking on the door saying, where defense, you know, the War Department is sorry to announce blah, 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 blah. You know, it's so they lived an extreme life. What could have been more extreme than that? But still, they imposed as a reaction against it. And this seems typical as far as life goes. It's kind of a thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. You know, some new thing is formed. The kids who grew up with the parents of the 50s and the culture of the 50s, which was quiet and sort of suppressive and repressive and very square, and everybody, you know, had, there was a certain kind of normality which was imposed on everybody, right? Nobody wanted any kind of extremism. And then the kids who grew up under this, got restless and felt like they were being kept in a box, and they didn't want to have crew cuts, and they didn't want to have, you know, ponytails and long dresses, and they didn't want to have the same jeans and the same sneakers, and they didn't want to, you know, follow in their father's footsteps and go into the job with them or get a job in an insurance company like everybody, like Father Knows Best. If you ever saw that show, that TV show, Father Knows Best, if you ever got a chance to see it, if you've never seen it, take a look at a couple of episodes of Father Knows Best, which was the big hit of the 50s. And it was the ultimate American life. It was what life was supposed to be. Guy goes to work in an insurance company. Jim Anderson comes home. He's got the lovely wife. He's a lovely guy. He's got the three kids. And they have their sort of problems. But there's nothing extreme about any of it. It's all sort of within a kind of narrow box of achievement, Americanism, decency, fair play, all that kind of stuff. It's what everybody at least wanted the country to be, or what they pretended it was like then. And then the 60s came, and it's all, you know, rebellion again. It's turning against that. It's turning against that. It's sex, it's drugs, it's rock and roll, it's rebellion, it's breaking the rules, stereotypes. And a lot of it was, like I say, a sort of natural generational rebellion that happens in cycles. If you look back at various decades, like the 20s, for instance, was a very rebellious time. There was a lot of rebellion going on, a lot of young people. You know, jazz was a big thing. It was considered raunchy, and, you know, it was actually came from black people. You know, it was it had its jungle roots. This is the kind of thing that people used to call it, right? Who denounced it. And people were drinking all over. I mean, terrible alcoholism. And this is even before the actually, it wasn't. It was this is the alcohol was part of the crime, the tremendous crime spree that was occurred by, you know, by the passing of the prohibition law. So it was a time of extremism and violence in its own way and crazy expansiveness and aggressiveness. But probably that was in reaction to the decade or two before that, which was all, you know, very repressive. All, you know, it was where everybody was doing exactly what they were supposed to do and everybody was obeying the rules. These things go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So I get to be 15 growing up through the 50s, and everything is a Leave It to Beaver and you know, Father Knows Best. But then I get to the 60s, and not that I participated in it, to my regret, but enough, plenty of it. You know, there was political rebellion, and a lot of things changed permanently. It wasn't just a sort of a, you know, a cyclic thing, but, you know, civil rights, gay rights, women's rights, things that were taken for granted forever, you know, that were supposed to be kept in the closet, that women were supposed to stay in their place, that, you know, that gays were supposed to stay in their place, that blacks were supposed to stay in their place. All of this got turned upside down, and you can't say, you know, completely, but, like, it was a permanent change. And that music would always be, you know, kind of 50s music, for instance, is so different than 60s music. 50s music is kind of almost like sweet teenagerish, but 60s music became kind of like kind of full of darkness and strangeness and going out on the edge. And, you know, there's a Rolling Stones and there was sex and violence and all this. The 50s was all love and, you know, like going to the prom and all these. And it was great music, the 50s, right? I mean, it was always like Chuck Berry and other guys like that. And but the 60s was sex, drugs, rock and roll and rebellion. And I think what we'll do is play a little music to give you an idea. We'll play a little music to give you an idea of what the 50s and 60s were like in terms of what they sounded like and what the difference was between them. One was, I say, sort of like still an example of this kind of like pretty kind of external, sweet, sort of teenagerish, proper music, except, of course, for, you know, for Elvis Presley, who started upsetting people, and then, of course, all the black musicians who the larger white culture didn't pay any attention to, but they really did take a lot of their music from them, obviously. And then the 60s came in, and it was all strange and extreme and ecstatic and dark and violent. So let's play. We've got two of them in a row. Okay, let's hear that music.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. Well, you know you love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, when Cupid shot his dart, he shot it at your heart. So if we ever part, then I leave you. You sit and hold me and you tell me boldly that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day.
Okay, so that was the 50s, and then there was the 60s.
One.
All right, it's the 60s. Anyhow, now here I am, 70 years old. The 60s, it seems like a million years ago, right? Here I am, 70 years old, as of last Tuesday. And like I say, I was 70 years old at 6:49 p.m. on June 16th, 1945, 5:49 wartime. And there's an age gap. And I don't mean an age gap between generations, but there's an age gap inside all of us. No matter how old we are, we feel different ages depending on our development or what's happening in our lives at this time. But for me, it's probably more extreme. And I'm 70, but for reasons of the last year and a half of a lot of troubles that I've gone through, and because I've really never grown up very well or at all, I feel like I'm about 4 or 9. Some people say, well, I'm 70, yeah, but I feel like I'm, you know, 50. I feel like I'm 55 or 60. That's how I really feel inside. No, I'm 70, and I feel like I'm about 4 years old or 9 years old. And it's a kind of a vertiginous, it's a dizzying gap that I feel like I keep falling in between. So I'm always trying to, all I have to do is look and, you know, I mean, I've done all these things. I mean, I've been a husband 3 times. I have children, you know, I have jobs, careers, a welfare department, probation officer. You know, I was a paralegal. I was on the radio, still on the radio, doing performances, owned a bookstore, bought and sold old books. I've written books, done book abridgments, ton of things that I've done. But I still feel like it all passed like it was in a dream. Like I sort of fell asleep when I was a little kid, like when I was, you know, 5 years old or 10 years old. I fell asleep playing in my backyard, and I woke up like Rip Van Vader in the modern world. I look around at all this stuff, you know, all these devices. I walk in my living room. Used to be I walked in my living room, you know, when I was a kid, and it was just the living room. There was nothing on. It was dark. Now, if I walk in my living room, there's about 50 different colored lights peering around like little rat's eyes, you know, from like green, blue, red lights from every device and every, you know, every power cord and everything in the living room. It's really crazy. But I wonder all that stuff went. And sometimes you do start having sharp memories of your early childhood when you get to be this age. And I look at old pictures and I think, geez, who is that? Who is that? Because if I look at, you know, I see pictures of myself when I was holding a bat, cute little picture of myself holding a bat. I was about 7 years old, and I had a kind of, I had a little baseball uniform on. Might have been a Yankees uniform because I was a Yankees fan of all things. Not a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, but a Yankees fan. And I said, who is that kid? Who is that kid? That's a million years ago. What happened to that kid? What happened to that kid? Well, he's still inside. He's still inside. But now, and of course, if I look in the mirror, I see an old man, you know, and I see the way young people look at me. And, you know, people are offering me seats on the bus to the extent that they ever do that anymore. You know, people say, sir, would you like to sit down? In fact, I would often like to sit down. And some people age better than other people, obviously. I mean, we, you know, we're on Gary Null's radio station, and he is a proponent of, you know, aging the best way you can. And he's probably a pretty good example of it. And I have a friend who's done that, too, who's aged very well. I haven't aged too well, but when I look in the mirror now, I see this old skeleton, and I have old man hair. You know old man hair, which, like the eyebrows that come out and hair that comes out of your ears and your nose that you have to clip all the time? Where does that come from? When do you start getting old person's hair? I don't know. So there is a strange gap. I think all of us who are over a certain age feel this. And you feel it almost at any age, but you start thinking about it when you're in your 40s or 50s or 60s. It says there's a difference between you know, how old you are and how old you feel inside. And it's a question of responsibility and the kind of life you've led, but it's how you regard yourself too, and how you act, of course. And then, of course, you get to be, you know, 70 years old, and you get to be like, you know, you get to be 70 years old, and it's mortality. You know, I mean, you start feeling a sense of mortality in your 40s and 50s. God forbid at that age, you know, something happens to somebody, you know, who's that age, you know, and it would be a tragedy. But or if something happens, God forbid, to a child. But you know, when you get to be in your 40s and 50s is when your uncles and, you know, first of all, your grandparents die when you're, you know, in your teens or maybe in your 20s and or maybe a little older. And then you get to be in your 40s, 50s, and 60s, and your parents die. And then sometimes your friends, you know, get fatal diseases or are, you know, experiencing terrible tragedies in their own lives. And you start to get this feeling of mortality. This is assuming, of course, you don't grow up your whole life in a war zone. When you have a permanent feeling of mortality and death, what that must be like, I don't know. But if you grow up in a relatively, and it even changes in our own society, you grow up in you grow up in a rough neighborhood, you know, you got the white cops and you know, and black people all over the country. I mean, you know, if you grow up in a poor neighborhood anywhere and you grow up, let's say, black in the United States, you have an experience of mortality, which is a lot more constant and prevalent and than, you know, if you grew up in like the white lower middle class or the white middle class or something like that. But there is mortality. And then you get to be in your 60s, and now I'm 70, your friends have started to go from various illnesses, friends, colleagues, acquaintances. There is the fear of death, the fear of the last breath, the fear of the last breath coming out. And it hovers over you. It's there. It's in the background. Now, you could pay attention to it if you want, or you could ignore it and go on, or you could, you know, sort of... you could believe in an afterlife. People get more religious when they get older. people believe in reincarnation. They believe in reincarnation. That was a big thing. And the Buddhists believe in reincarnation. But then there is this sense of mortality. In fact, talking about Buddhists, there was one, I remember reading once, Alan Watts was writing about this, or somebody, that Buddhist monks in training, when Buddhist monks were in training, they they had a period, or they assigned them to sleep in cemeteries overnight and to sleep on the graves of their parents, to sleep in cemeteries and sleep on the graves of their ancestors. So they had a sense of what death was like. Because when you're young, you don't have a sense of mortality so much. Like I say, unless, of course, you grow up in a place where it's much more sudden and prevalent. And there are places in this country where obviously it is. All you have to do is read the papers to see it. But, or if you grow up in a lot of places in the world, sadly, I mean, just look at all the children and young people who are growing up in a place where there is sort of constant war and sudden death everywhere. I mean, sometimes you wonder yourself, you know, you say, you pick up the paper and you see like 40 people were killed and 160 people wounded or maimed in an explosion in a marketplace in some city in Pakistan or in, you know, in Iraq or someplace like that. you just don't ever know. You don't ever know. And mortality hangs over you. It hangs over you. I mean, these places in the Middle East, it's always there. And if you grew up in Vietnam during the Vietnamese War, and even before that, it was the Japanese, then it was the French, then it was the Vietnam War with the Americans. Imagine growing up in a place like that almost your entire life since you're a child. Mortality is right there. I mean, sudden and violent death is right there. But here, now at the age of 70, I had an extremely close friend who died in October. I've had other friends who die. I keep hearing about people who, you know, who have gotten illnesses which eventually will kill them, you know, heart attacks, like one that I got myself a year and a half ago. And so it's something that's there with you, you know. Like they say in L.A. Confidential in the movie, they say, the big adios, the long goodbye, it's right around the corner. And, you know, when that starts to happen, you start to review your life a lot. You know, I mean, you have to live your life. But living in the present is not everything. Not something I've always been excellent at. But, you know, I start thinking of what have I done in my life all these years? What have I actually done? It turns out there was a whole lot, but it didn't seem to me. Was that me who did it? You know, I can't hold on to it. even all those things I've done. But then I think about the regrets, all the things I haven't done. My wife made up for my birthday, an incredible work that she did. She made up, and it took her so long to do this, she made up a loose-leaf binder, really thick, like a phone book, of the best of the fan letters I got over 35 years on the radio, and all this stuff that people wrote to me about what my show meant to them, and I don't even recall it. I can't hold it in my hand. It's extraordinary to look at that. I did all that. I was a probation officer. I'm a father, you know. I was married. I had sex, you know, all these times. I have friends. And you start wondering, what does it all add up to? There's this great circle. There's this great circle of the first breath you take and the last breath you take. And then you start wondering, is there a connection between age and wisdom? Well, not often. One thing I realize right now, at my age, at the age of 70, just becoming 70, is that instead of knowing more than I ever did, I know less than I ever did. I really know less than I ever did. And maybe that's a kind of wisdom in itself. Maybe that's a kind of wisdom in itself.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here's one you all can sing with us when the saints go marching in. Beautiful audience out there swinging with us. On behalf of Jewel Brown, Billy Kyle, Joe Daringsburg, Summer Young, Billy Crook, Danny Barcelona, little Filipino boy on the drums. Little Arabian boy, saxophone. We are very happy to have swung this number for you folks. It's cutting out time now. Before we cut out from here, let's take them saints on down one more time. Now I win the saints. Watch it. Whoa, boy. When the saints chilling. Yes, I found me in that number.